Welcome to the Coaching Coordinator Podcast. We are at the New York State High School Coaches Association Clinic, and joining me on the podcast is the offensive line coach from Alabama, Kyle Flood. Coach, it's great to have you here.
It's great to be here. I appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, absolutely. Most of the time I do these over the phone, so it's pretty neat to be able to sit face-to-face and talk to somebody, but I was able to catch a little bit of your first clinic talk. You had two here, and you know, it's great to see coaches supporting this clinic and coming out and trying to make New York football the best it can be.
Yeah, this clinic's always been very special to me. I've had the opportunity to come up here and speak before. Being somebody who grew up in New York City, a product of New York football, both high school and college, I get to see a lot of faces that I've known for a long time. And a lot of these high school coaches, the reason I'm in the position I'm in today is because I got a chance to coach their players. So if I get a chance to give back, I want to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And your journey definitely went through New York, St. Francis Prep, as a player and then a coach, I believe, right?
Yes, I had a chance to play at St. Francis Prep for Vince O'Connor. Other than my parents, you know, one of the biggest influences really that I had in my life, just a really special guy to a lot of players over the years. I mean, he was the head coach at St. Francis, I believe, for over 50 years. So just a really special person in the football community and certainly at St. Francis Prep overall. And then to get the opportunity after playing at Iona to go back there and coach with him gave me a whole new perspective on what made him special as a football coach and why, you know, not only was he able to win a lot of championships, but why he was able to impact so many lives.
And then, Coach, you moved on to Iona College to play. Talk to us a little bit about that experience. I mean, I find that a lot of coaches who I talk to on the podcast, that's kind of where they develop the desire to coach and started their network, and it builds from there.
Going through high school football, I knew I wanted to play college football, and ultimately it was going to be somewhere in what used to be the Liberty Conference, which was St. John's, Iona, CW Post, the Merchant Marine Academy, and I ended up looking at all those schools, but there was a gentleman named Rob Spence who had just taken the offensive coordinator's job at Iona, and Rob had been the head coach at Iona Prep, the high school, which was in the same league that I played in, and he knew me from the All-Star game that we had played in after that season. And my familiarity with him ultimately was the reason that I went there. One of the other reasons I went there was my older brother actually was already in school there. He was a scholarship tennis player there. But it was a great choice for me, and it was a program that I fit into really well. And I ended up while I was there, having an offensive line coach by the name of Tim Keppel my junior and senior year. And really, Tim Keppel is the reason I ended up in college coaching. And he was the guy who, when I was teaching high school math at St. Francis Prep and coaching high school football there, gave my name to Tommy Marshall at CW Post because they needed an offensive line coach, but they didn't have a full-time position to do it. And I was close enough that I could, and I got kind of recommended by Tim Keppel, and it really changed my life.
When you look back at those early days as a coach, what were some of the most important lessons you learned that really you've carried through your career?
Yeah, I would tell you, being with Mr. O'Connor and coaching with Mr. O'Connor for 2 years, the most impactful thing that I took from that experience was that when you were speaking with him, it didn't matter who you were as a player. You could have been a Division III player like myself or a Division I player like a guy like Marco Battaglia who played at my high school. You were the most important person in the world to him, and it was so important to him that you find the right fit. It wasn't about the level of play that you were going to go to in college. It was about finding the right fit as a player, the right fit academically. So that lesson from Mr. O'Connor has always stuck with me through my entire career. Then I had the chance to go to work for Tom Marshall at CW Post, and very quickly I remember being in my second year there, and I had a rotation at right tackle. One player was a senior, and then one player was a freshman. And we were getting towards the last game of the year, which was like the ECAC bowl game back then. And I remember going into coach's office and being a young coach, saying, "Hey, coach, I'm not sure who you think, you know, who do you think we should start in this game?" And kind of putting the decision on him as the head coach. And he said something with me that I've never forgotten. He said, "Well," he said, "Kyle, let me ask you this question. If your job was on the line, who would you start?" And so that was like my first introduction into the real business of coaching. You know, I'd never really thought of it in those terms before. And, you know, the idea that, hey, you know, ultimately we're here for a lot of reasons, but winning is one of them, and winning is important. So this is not intramurals anymore. This is college football, and I've never forgotten that either.
Coach, you've had some experiences where you've been able to coach at pretty much every level. You know, at Delaware, Rutgers, Hofstra, Iona, spent some time with the Falcons. Now you're at Alabama. As you look at, I guess, the things that are different at those levels, but also the things that really stay consistent for you as you've moved through the different levels.
Yeah, I will tell you, for years, I always thought that as I moved up, that the players would need me less, or would need coaching less is probably a better way to say that. And it's really not true. What I found is, as you move up, it gets more and more challenging, because the players who play at a high level, they want to be coached at a high level. And you're going to the Falcons and being around a guy like Alex Mack, who probably will end up in the Hall of Fame someday as a center, watching the way he went about his business and his appetite for coaching and his appetite for information really made a huge impact on me. And I think it made me a better college coach when I came back to college. And even at a place like Alabama, where we're fortunate to have a lot of talented players, they need coaching. The ones who succeed want the coaching. They want to be coached. They want to be critiqued, because they want to be the best. They're highly competitive people.
Now being at Alabama, certainly, a team that not just the sports world looks towards, but, you know, business people look at how that organization is run and just the detail and everything that goes into the culture there. What have you, I guess, been most impressed with as you've spent your time there? I know it's just a year for you.
Yeah, it's about a full year now. I think it's something you know when you go there, because everybody's familiar now with what Coach Saban has done and the success that he's had and the standards that he's set. But when you're living it on a day-to-day basis in that building and you're experiencing the day-to-day standards of excellence in every area, not just on the field, but in the training room, in the weight room, in the support for the student athletes, in really every aspect of their life, there is a demand for excellence on a day-in and day-out basis. And that type of culture, having been a head coach, I totally understand how hard that is to establish that type of culture. And to be in it every day and see what Coach Saban has created there, it's a special place.
I guess, how has it changed you as a coach? What improvements has it made to the way you go about things? I mean, you have a great career here. You spent a long time at this, but every opportunity is a new situation to learn in.
It absolutely is. I don't know that it has necessarily changed me as a coach, but I do think that when you work somewhere as an assistant, you want to work somewhere where the head coach is going to make you better. And I think Coach Saban's drive on a day-in, day-out basis makes everybody on the staff better. And to do that, despite all the success that he has already had, is very unique. And it's why not a lot of places have been able to replicate what he's done in Alabama. So that part has certainly had an impact on me.
Coach, flipping things over to the X's and O's side, was able to catch part of your talk, as I said. You know, you mentioned in there that you guys run everything, right? And we watch all those games, power counter, duo, inside zone, outside zone, run some toss. The only thing you don't run is the draw. And certainly
we
those
have
are,
in the playbook. We just didn't call it.
Those are all good tools to have. You have excellent players. There's high standards there. For you, how do you manage going about to teach all of those at, you know, a level of detail that you need for those plays to be successful?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, because, you know, this is really probably the most volume of run game that I've been around. And I think it was very good for us this year that we had it. And I think in your coaching, the amount of times that you can say same as, your players get better. So if you can teach a settle step and a shoulder lift on a gap scheme the same way you teach it on a zone, on an inside zone scheme, well, then every time you practice it, you're really practicing both schemes. So as we don't ever want to sacrifice the details of a play,
right,
just so we can say same as. We don't do that. But there are some instances from a technique standpoint where we are able to do that. And, you know, the shoulder lift's probably the easiest example of that.
Right. And when you can find those, it it makes it more efficient in the way that you drill as well with the same as. So it's not two separate drills, because we do this. It's one drill that works this technique and this play and this play.
No question. And I talked about this today with some of the high school coaches that were here. You know, to me, I think you can get bogged down in your individual periods if you're trying to get 10, 15 reps of the same thing in a day. You know, we get 1 to 2 reps of a skill, and then we move on to the next one and the next one, and then we'll come back to it either the next day or the day after. But we can't spend all of our time on one skill a day, because we won't get to everything that we need to get to.
Right. I can remember having a lot of debates with coaches, whether it's been in person or on social media or whatever it be, is how many times do you need to rep something for it to be effective? And I think people lose sight of, we need it this many times in a week. It really becomes, at least I believe, the cumulative effect of those reps over the course of, you know, spring ball, a season, a guy's career.
Yeah, I agree. It's definitely the cumulative effect. And I think you can't get weighed down in your practice plans as an offensive line coach with what the defense your team runs is doing, because if you're spending all the time trying to scheme your own defense, there's going to be too many other things that are going to come up there in the year. And I tell the players this, and I'll say it here, that if you don't get it taught in training camp, so whatever your training camp is, if you don't get all of the skills taught, not that they're going to be mastered in training camp, because that's why you have a whole season. You know, hopefully you're getting better as the season goes on. But if you don't get those skills at least introduced and taught during training camp, it's very hard to introduce them in with the time constraints of a game week.
Absolutely. Well, Coach, the one thing, you know, said don't get bogged down by your own defense. You did mention that SEC, it's the tight front or the four eyes. You see those all the time.
We do. There's a lot of Nick Saban defensive coordinators in the SEC for sure.
But you also talked about in your first talk, you're talking about the wide zone and the technique you like to use against that. If you would talk our listeners through the technique that you like.
Going to Alabama was really the first time that I had encountered as much of that front as we had. And then you start looking at your opponents and you see the Kirby Smarts and the guys in that league, Jeremy Pruitt, and who have worked on his staff and run a very similar version of what Coach Saban runs on defense. And when we started blocking outside zone to the four-eye side, so the tight end's going to handle the Sam, and now we're comboing the four-eye to the mic, we were using hands. Mm-hmm. And what I found was the tackle was getting flattened out by the four-eye. The four-eye was almost playing inside out through his inside number, and we were getting stretched out. So the tackle's feet are going backwards. The guard really couldn't fit the combination the way we wanted to, and I just never felt good about it. So we decided we were going to treat the four-eye like a two-eye. And we started settle stepping and then shoulder lifting the four eye and allowing the guard to get into it and really putting the premium on the vertical movement of the four eye. Even if it made us a little bit late on the mic, we could always kind of secure the four eye and kick the mic out and run the ball in the seam in between those two guys. And when we started doing that, the plays got a lot better.
How do you like to drill those? I think you mentioned using the Crowther.
Well, we do some shoulder lifting on a Crowther sled. We don't really drive sleds because I think you end up leaning on them, but we do lift sleds. And so for that settle kind of shoulder lift, that's the sled that we use right now, and it's been good to us.
You mentioned using the pin and pull as well. You know, for you guys, certainly it's good to have those tools. Is there a front you prefer certain things against, or when you guys are looking at it in game planning, if it's going to be part of the game plan, do you look to run things against every front?
For us, we have to really be ready to run them against multiple fronts, because whether it's our defense or the versions of our defense that we see, most of the teams in our conference will play us in even and odd fronts, and we're not always sure of which structure we're going to get more of. So we have to be ready to block both. The pin pull plays on the outside zone were good for us, and I try to tell people to be guarded against adding things. For us, we did it, and it was good to us because we were running so much zone. We felt like the linebackers were fitting the plays too easily. They were fitting it downhill too easily on us and pulling us off our double teams. And now, you block down on whether it's a four-eye or a three technique, whatever it is, and you're pulling one or two players to the outside, you're changing a lot of gaps for the linebackers. So now you're giving them a completely different picture than just a zone scheme that they can kind of flat wall defense every time. So we probably run them both about the same amount of time, but I would not have anticipated that going into the season. I didn't think we'd run as much pin pull as we did, but it was really good for us. And I thought it declared really easily for the runners. I thought they were able to hit the seams full speed.
You know, over the course of a single game, as your guys are coming to the sideline, is there anything that they're telling you that in that particular game might lead you to lean on one play more than another?
We always want to know a couple things that we always want to know, like, hey, how do we want to handle the backside? You know, how are we able to get the backside two eye cut off or the backside shaded nose guard cut off? Those are things we want to know right away. You know, how vertical is he playing? Is he a reader? Is he a penetrator? Is he a guy we can cut? Is he not a guy we can cut? So we don't cut a lot, but we do use it against some of the penetrating defenses for sure. We'll do some of that. And then on the front side, I always want to know, like, when we are pin pulling a three technique, how is that guy playing? Is he trying to wipe us over the top? If he is, we may have to change our target a little bit if we feel that, you know, he doesn't have any weight on his hand and he's doing that. But for the most part, we want to call plays that allow us to block the support of the defense. So whether you give us a three-down structure or a four-down structure, to me, we've got hats for all those guys. It's really how we're going to handle the support, whether it's a rotating safety down or a quarters coverage safety. And whatever it is, how we handle those guys is really the key to the success of the run game, in my opinion.
Coach, flipping over to pass protection. And, you know, defenses today are doing, you know, a lot of exotic blitzes. Some teams are better at it than others, and certainly you guys face some teams that are great at those things. So you see a lot of teams trying to do some different things to you, whether it's creepers or sims, you know, simulated blitzes or, you know, the different pressures you might see. What's the key for you guys to consistently block things up, especially with all that kind of movement?
Yeah, the coordination between the running backs and the linemen is critical. Every opportunity we get in practice to block blitzes, we do it. We take that. And that was something I took away from being in Atlanta with the Falcons. Every opportunity we had to block blitzes before practice, after practice, whether it's a special teams walkthrough, a special teams period where the linemen aren't involved, we were blocking blitzes. In the NFL, you have different rules in phase one, phase two. There's only so many things you can do. There's certain times of year you can't get together with all 11. But you can get together with six and you can block blitzes. So we did that. So it became an all-year-round process, you know, in Atlanta, and that was something we absolutely brought here. So whether it's pre-practice, walkthrough, in-practice, special teams period where the linemen aren't involved, we are going to be blocking blitzes every opportunity we get. And I think that's the only way you can do it and get good at it. And then the other part of that is you have to have protections that you trust. And what I mean is, if you're trying to rig a protection every week to block a certain blitz, first of all, you may not even see that blitz. You may see a different version of it. So I think you can jam yourself up and confuse your own players when you do that. And to me, if you're a good protection team, yes, your linemen have to block the blitzes and your running backs got to be coordinated. But most teams that are good protection teams are also good protection teams because the quarterback gets the ball out on time. So I think that's another key to that. We had a lot of success this year on third down and blocking blitzes, and some of that reason is the ability of guys like Tua and Mac Jones to get the ball out in rhythm and get it out on time to make sure that the blitzes don't get to us when we are hot.
Certainly with those guys, it's their level of understanding, and I can remember watching a video NFL Network of Joe Thomas talking about, you know, finding different keys in the defense, and sometimes looking from guys coming from the secondary, and you guys certainly see things like that all the time. How do you teach your linemen to start to recognize some of those tip-offs to, you know, the guys coming from level three this time?
Sure. I think there's things every week you look at, and it's body language, it's alignments. Is the defensive end a little bit tighter now than he was before? Is the linebacker stance different now than it was before? The rotation of the safeties is always a pretty good indicator, especially in college football where the hashes are so much wider. You don't see as much all-out disguise like you do in the NFL. It's a little tougher in the NFL. With the hashes being closer, the disguises are tougher.
Right.
But in college, I think alignments, stances, and safety rotation, that's kind of where it starts.
Coaches, you know, linemen, a lot of times, you know, we're just thinking about those five, but formations certainly affect a lot of things. Do you guys look at formations, whether it be for the run game or for pass protection, as to what might give you the advantage? Do you count in some of those variations that you might see that, let's say, you're going to use a tight end and a running back versus 10 personnel?
Sure. Yeah, I think always, you know, you always look to see how a defense plays a certain personnel group. And then within that personnel group, how do they play the formations? And like I said before, like the front is really not the issue in my opinion, because it's much more about the coverage and the run support if you're talking about the run game. And pass protection, there's definitely stuff you can do formationally, whether it's a compressed formation, just to put somebody near that defensive end, whether he's going to chip or not. Sometimes even just having him in a compressed formation can help you slow down a rusher. Now, compressed formations also help disguise for the defense.
Right.
So
there's
a little bit of give and take with those as well. But putting tight ends in motion to chip a really good defensive end, you know, running a running back through the B gap to chip the outside half is really good. Three techniques so the guard can sit on his inside number. There's absolutely things formationally and motion wise you can do to help your lineman.
Yeah, I can remember years ago I was recruiting in Tampa when I was at BW, and I had the opportunity to sit down with John Gruden for a night in his Fire Football Coaches Association office, and you know, we got into this nudge protection. He was showing me the Saints doing it. Very effective. Are there things, though, as you look at that, because I think a lot of it does rely on the technique and remembering back to when we put it in, how do you coach up some of those chips for those guys? Because really, those guys engage with the defender, and I think the lineman has to be patient. How are you coaching that up as you're going to chip?
Sure, yeah, I think if you're a tackle and you know that you're going to get help, whether it's chip help or just the presence of a tight end for a certain amount of time before he leaves for his route, you're definitely going to sit on a tighter target. You're going to sit a little bit more inside. Now, part of the coaching for the guy who's doing the chipping or giving the presence, he has to make sure that he's on the outside half of that defensive end, or there's a chance he could undercut the tackle, and then you're creating a problem instead of solving a problem. But I think, you know, understanding that, hey, when you're using chip, presence, nudge, whatever the term is you use, you're using that to eliminate speed rush. So don't set for a lot of depth. And don't set very wide, because he should be pushing the defender into you.
Speaking of sets, as you're looking at your tackles, I'm sure you have a toolbox of different sets that they're going to use. You know, how often are your guys changing things up? I mean, you see all kinds of, you know, freaks of nature at defensive end and outside linebacker.
Yeah, there's good.
Is that necessary for you guys to do quite a bit?
Yeah, there's good. There's definitely good D linemen in the SEC for sure. I think, you know, your players, you want to have an angle set, a vertical set. You want to have some type of rock set or jump set, whatever you call that. And then you got to know when to use them. But the reality is the best pass protection is a good run game.
Yeah.
The more you can make those guys on defense worry about you running the ball, the better pass protector you're going to be for sure. And then on third down, then you got to be ready for whatever the exotics are going to be. You know, in college football is a little different than the NFL. In the NFL, certain teams that have, you know, a high level of pass rushers on their team, those guys will mostly line up with four guys and let them rush the passer, because that's kind of what they get paid to do.
Mm-hmm.
In college, it's a little different. You don't see a lot of that. Everybody has kind of a third down pressure package that they go to. So when you get to third down, it's really a little bit more about that than it is necessarily just the straight pass rush or the games and things like that.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. We saw the Niners ride that all the way to the Super Bowl,
right.
The great running game. And, you know, that was the quarterback's best friend for sure. I mean, you know, when that guy only has to throw eight passes in an NFC championship game, you don't see that quite a bit.
Yeah, your protection gets a lot better if you only throw it eight times.
That's right. Well, Coach, as we wind up here, you've had a lot of great experiences. You're at a great place right now. You know, it was neat to see you talking about all the different things you do and see your guys performing at a high level. But if you look at all the things you do as a coach, what's the one thing you feel really gives your players the winning edge?
I think what the players are looking for are answers. They want answers. So it doesn't really matter what level of football you're coaching at. Ultimately, your players are competing against people from other teams, and they want to know that when they have a problem, you have an answer for them. And I think as a coach, as an offensive line coach, you have to really sit down and think about, okay, what are your beliefs? What are your beliefs on the stance you want your players in? What are your beliefs on the targets you want them to hit? If you're going to use a shoulder, when are you going to use shoulder blocking? How do you want your players to finish? And when they don't finish that way, how do you hold them accountable to finishing that way? But I've always felt like there's definitely got to be a personal connection with you and your players. It's college football, and even in the NFL, the players want to have that personal connection with you. But from a football standpoint, they want to know that when they're not getting something right, that you've got something to help them get it right, and you've got the answers for them.
Well, Coach, I appreciate you taking time and especially being here to help out New York football.
No, it was my pleasure being here. I appreciate you having me on.